Could you say your name for me, Clayton?
Clayton Ryder.
Could you do that again?
Clayton Ryder.
And again?
Clayton Ryder.
Yeah, it should be lovely. Thank you. Right, Clayton, thank you for talking to me. Can you tell me something about your background? I'd be really interested in knowing how you got into charcoal burning.
I got into charcoal burning due to my job at the Dean Heritage Centre. We're one of the few places in the country that does traditional charcoal burns on a regular basis. And as my role as site manager here, I take care of preparing the burn, getting everything ready for people and volunteers from who come from all over the country to learn how to do the charcoal burning. It's been my role for getting on for 12 years now to prepare everything and take part in the charcoal burn. So that's how I got into it.
Okay, and how many charcoal burns do you do a year?
We do two a year. And we do special event charcoal burns if we need to do them.
Yeah, and you're saying you have people from all over the country come to learn how to do it?
Yeah, they'll come to learn how to do it in the traditional way. The traditional way is an earth and turf burn, what they call an earth and turf burn. Most places that do it now do it with a kiln, so they'll do it in a completely different way, which is much more effective, if you like. You get more charcoal than you do with a traditional burn. You get a lot of things called what we call brunts, which are burnt ends, which are pieces of wood that haven't turned completely to charcoal. When you use a kiln, you tend to get a higher yield.
Yeah, and well, I'll come back and ask you some more questions about that, but in terms of your background, where did you learn how to charcoal burn? Where did you get trained?
I learned through the Dean Heritage Centre. It's been happening on site here for the last 30 odd years. It was something that a guy called Peter Ralph started, who used to work for the Forestry Commission. He started doing it over 30 years ago. So as far as nationally concerned, you know, Pete's probably one of the best at this sort of thing. Within the country in a traditional way. There are one or two other guys that know what they're doing with the traditional side, but Pete's been doing it here for 30 odd years. So,
well, where did he learn? Where did he get his skills from?
It's kind of a passed on thing with Pete and a bit of experimentation, because that sort of died out a number of years ago, the traditional earth and turf burn.
Yeah.
So it's been revived as much as a hand down, if you like. The information's out there if you know where to look, but you know, some of us have got family links within this sort of thing as well, and that's how it's come about, really.
Do you have any family? Which family members of yours were involved in charcoal?
You're going back a long, long time. For instance, in the Forest of Dean, around about the 12th, 13th century, talking about 900 charcoal burners just within the Forest of Dean. All of us who have been in the Forest of Dean for a long time are pretty much related to at least one of them. So, if you wanted to trace it back that way, you could. The last charcoal burner in the Dean was a guy called Roberts, who was down around Gunsmills. Gunsmills belonged to my family at that sort of time. So we've got links with charcoal on that side of things as well.
That's down at Flaxley.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Gunsmills was my grandfather was born there. He married a girl who just lived up the way, who was related to the Teagues. The Teagues were known as an industrial family, and they bought the tramways to the Forest of Dean and stuff like that. So my links from my side of the family run right through the history of the Forest of Dean.
Yeah. And in terms of Mr. Ralph teaching you charcoal burning, can you explain to me again the sort of the basic principles? And you said that with the Dean way of doing it is different to perhaps other places. Could you explain that a bit more detail?
Yeah, it's something that's grown up in and around different parts of the country. They all had a little bit of a quirk about how they did these things. And a simple example would be you start off with a flue that runs up the middle of the stack. Some places do it with a pole, so they'll remove the pole once the stack is built around it, so you've got a flue. Other people build the flue triangular shaped, so you've got that ready to build round. We do it in a square shape with a chimney that runs up the middle. I wouldn't say it was traditionally just the Forest of Dean way of doing things, but it's how we've adapted it to suit what we've got around us, really.
And can you tell me, you do now, when you do a charcoal burn, where do you get the wood from here?
We source the wood from all over the place, really. Depends on who's coppiced at the time. If we know somebody who's coppiced in a certain area, we'll approach them. Sometimes we'll do a complete 2 ton of wood. We usually put 2 ton of burn. So we can harvest that from the woodlands that we manage here.
Okay, could you tell me something about the preparation then, how you prepare for the burn?
Yeah, we'll cut cords of wood. It'll be about 8-9 feet length. We'll bring them onto site. We'll cut them then into 18-inch to 2-foot lengths. They'll all be taken up to the charcoal burn site. They'll be, sometimes they're barn dried, sometimes they're just air dried. But once they're dried, then we can use them and get a better product with it. We can't use anything that's wet or anything like all green. 2 ton of burn, when we hope to get around about 1/4 ton of charcoal out of that. The preparation is everything goes up. We'll build the chimney, then we'll build around it in concentric circles around that chimney till all the wood is used, and it's dome shaped because obviously you've got to dress that with turf after it's built. And if it's too steep on either side, the turf will just fall away. You'll end up getting air getting into the stack and it'll just burn away. So it's got to be the correct shape. Once the correct shape's built, we cover it with sections of turf. Once that turf is covered over, then we get some earth, tip that on the turf, seals all the gaps. Get a good fire going in the hearth next to it. Put a lot of hot ash down the middle of the chimney, which is still exposed. Pack that out with dry wood. Once the flames start to lick out the top, usually takes 3/4 hour to 1 hour, we know that the stack is lit. The clamp, as they call it, is lit. Once that's happened, we seal the top off, so there's no air getting to it, and then we punch a load of holes about 1 foot from the top, all the way around the top of the stack. The colour of the smoke that comes out of those holes tells us what's going on inside the stack. It comes out white smoky stuff to start with, which is quite toxic. You just can't breathe and stuff like that. As time goes on, eventually you'll get a bluey smoke coming from there. Then you know you've got carbon in there and you've got charcoal. Once that happens, you seal those holes off and lower them down by 1 foot. And the same process goes on again from those holes, because as the stack gets nearer to the bottom, it gets wider. So you've got more wood to turn to charcoal. Once that happens and you get all the way to the bottom, the last set of holes turn to blue, you know that the stack is cooked. Then you can seal it all off. We tend to pump a load of water in there just to put the worst of the fire out and let the steam do the work then to stop any flare-ups or anything like that. Seal it off with any spare turf and earth that we've got and open it up the following day. And hopefully we end up with about 1/4 ton of charcoal.
So how long is that from start to finish?
Start from finish is anything from sort of 2 days to 5 days, depending on how dry the wood is when we put it in and all that sort of stuff, and particularly the type of wood we put in.
And how do you have to monitor it quite closely?
It's watched 24 hours a day for as long as the burn takes.
So somebody stays there?
Somebody's watching. They're listening and watching, whether it be night or day. You're listening for pops and cracks and things like that, and things breaking and opening up. And that's why it's got to be watched, because if it does, if a side falls out or something like that and the air gets in, it's just going to burn away and you get nothing but ash.
Yeah. And how many of you are normally involved in it?
There will be around about 8 to 10 people that are involved per year. They'll do a variety of shifts, so you're doing perhaps a 6 or 12 hour shift, depending on whether you're doing a day one or a night one.
Yeah. And some of those people are trainees or people who are learning how to do it?
People who are learning, yeah. We always get 2 or 3 people come along every year that want to start picking up what it's all about, because it's a traditional skill that no longer takes place everywhere and anywhere. Mm. For obvious reasons, it's quite a dirty job. There's a lot of smoke that's produced by it, and lots of people don't want to be around that, especially if they got the washing on the line, that type of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The charcoal.
But the smell itself is unique. You know a charcoal burn once you smell it, and it's something. It's literally it is a unique thing, and it's a very nice thing. You know, you can actually sit in amongst the charcoal smoke, and it won't bother you at all. You will smell a charcoal or see once you've finished it, but it's different to sitting next to a normal fire smoke.
Yeah. And what do you do with the charcoal you produce?
Once we produce that product, it's sold through the shop for barbecue charcoals and stuff like that. Yeah. It's quite easy to light. You don't have to pump any lighter fluid or anything like that in it. Something like 95% of the charcoal in this country is imported. Only 5% is own produced. And the first thing these people have got to do when they export is to douse it and stuff, stop it catching fire, because it's a flammable product. Which is why you see people pumping lighter fuel and all that sort of stuff and fire lighters into it just to get it going. They've got to get rid of all the stuff that's on it before it will actually do what it's supposed to say.
Yeah. Do Do you know anything about how it was used historically in the Dean?
Historically, it's obviously for metal production and stuff like that to get a better quality, because obviously it burns at a greater heat than wood or coal or anything like that. So it was used for smelting iron and stuff like that.
Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you. About to say something else.
I can't remember what I was going to say.
Yeah.
It's a lot of things. It's something that's got a massive amount of information that goes with it.
Mm.
People have written books and books and books on it. Mm. But the Forest of Dean has got a particular history with it, and nothing is too far away from it. If you walked 99% of the woods around here, you will come across a charcoal arth. Whether you recognise it as an arth, you know, is a different thing. But somebody, once they know what they look like, you can walk the Dean and see thousands of them.
Yeah, and you can recognise them, you can.
Yeah.
So what would it look like if you saw it in the
woods? It's more or less, it's an unusual flattened area, because it's got to be done on a flat area. So once you've seen them, you pick them out. They'll even have carved the banks out to create a flat area for the charcoal to be done in.
Yeah.
You wouldn't always bring the wood to where the charcoal was being burnt. You would create that space within the woodland that you were working and turning into charcoal.
Yeah. So you could tell where they are.
Yeah.
And in terms of other charcoal burners, are there any other than you and the Dean now? Do you know of?
The only people in the Forest of Dean that do charcoal burning have come through the Dean Heritage Centre. So there are people who have come through Pete Ralph and the guys who do the burn. And there's only a very few that will do it externally from the Dean Heritage Centre. Predominantly everything charcoal-wise is done here within the Forest of Dean.
Yeah. And you're saying there's lots of books written about that now. Is there any particular books you've
recommend? There's information. There's lots of information about there. You know, you can read the books that Cyril Art's published and stuff like that. He's done quite a bit about charcoal burning. Some of our former trustees and local historians, they've written documents on it.
Mm.
Yeah, there's a few about that have written about it.
Yeah. And you're very much involved in the Dean Heritage Centre.
I am, yeah. I'm employed part-time for the Dean Heritage Centre, and I do a carving, so we've got a carving set up here as well. So we're still working the woodlands around here.
Yeah.
All the timber we carve comes from the Forestry Commission. We buy it off them, we bring it in, we carve all sorts of stuff. So we do trails and that for the museum, as well as my role here as site manager.
Yeah. So you've got quite a commitment to the centre.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much.
No problem.
Thank you. I read an article about a woman who wrote about coming to witness a charcoal burn. I don't know if you've ever seen that story, but she wrote about coming into the woodland, and she said the people there were they had some cider and they were singing songs, and so I just wondered, is it as sociable as that?
It is, yeah. We have a guy who's a cider maker. And he doesn't drink it himself, but he would bring a keg of cider in. And of an evening, we've had blacksmiths and that come down and play fiddles, and we've had guys up there. But the burn is the centrepiece. Everybody is playing that role of looking after the burn. Everything else that goes on around it, you know, sometimes it's social, sometimes you're up there on your own, you know, but all those elements play a part in it.
Yeah.
And it's nice to be part of the social side, and it's nice to be up there on your own. Just you and the charcoal burn, because that's time served.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a cultural event as well.
It is. There's a lot more to it than just sitting and watching a pile of wood, you know what I mean?
Yeah, this particular author said she learned about the story of the bears and Ruadine at the charcoal burn.
Yeah, she would do. That's a story that's a lot more popular now than it ever has been before, because obviously it was a little bit of a touchy subject years ago.
Yeah. Well, you're not from Ruadine, are you?
I'm not from Ruadine, no. But I know the families of some of the guys who were involved in killing the bears.
Mm.
And we know where one of the bears is buried, or so say one of the bears is buried.
Yeah. Are the people still touchy now, do you think?
Some of them are. Ruadine people are. And it wasn't nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
You know, it's people from Cinnivert, really, that killed the bears. People from Cinnivert and Drybrook.
Oh, well, I've heard two stories about that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a book published on that actually documents the name of the people who were responsible for it.
Yeah.
And we've had guys come down. I've carved 7-8 feet tall bears down here. And we've had guys who were relatives of those who killed those two bears come down and their picture took them. But police officers and all were all over the coals because of that job.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It was infamous. It was quite a story, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Still is a little bit. I played a lot of rugby for Drybrook Rugby Club, and lots of the Bristol sides come up, and the first thing they'd say to you was, "Who killed the Bears?"
Yeah.
We used to laugh about it when I played, but prior to that, it's a very touchy subject.
Yeah. Do you have any contact with the other sort of traditions, sheep commoning or free mining?
Members of my family were free miners. I've not mined myself. I've been down a few mines, I've never mined myself. I've done sculptures of free miners. I know people, one of my girlfriend's previous girlfriends was a commoner. We know guys who were up on the top.
Who was your girlfriend that was a commoner?
Are you recording this?
Let's leave the name out.
Yeah, we'll leave the name out, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, I've been involved in that sort of stuff.
Yeah. But you never fancied keeping some sheep yourself? Or?
No, I keep pigs, so it's a different thing for me. There aren't too much commoning rights. We used to have, as a pig breeder, you would have pannage rights.
Yeah.
So you turn your pigs out for pannage, but we don't do that anymore. Obviously, there's a boar about. Not only that, it's got turned to be quite expensive because you'd have to have a vet in on site to check your pig out before you turned it out, and a vet on site to check your pigs back in once you brought them back in. And it's really not that, you know.
Do you look after the pigs here?
They're mine, yeah.
They're yours?
They belong to me, not the museum.
Yeah, somebody said they came from Adam Henson's.
They did, I bought them from him.
Yeah?
Yeah. Up until these two pigs, I had a breeding program here. We started when I first came here 11 years ago, 12 years ago. And we would breed pigs up, bring two wieners in. Once they became sows, take them off site, breed them, get two wieners off them, bring them in. And that cycle carried on for about 11 years. And then going back 18 months, we stopped that.
You stopped the cycle? Why did you
stopped
that?
The cycle. We run out of boars, to be honest with you. There's only four male strains and 10 female strains. I'd exhausted the male strains in this area. So we would have had to go out beyond sort of 50 miles. Which means you've got to get a double driver, it means you've got all sorts of different laws and legislations you've got to go through.
Yeah.
So it just became more of a bind financially than it is. You can't make any money as it is.
Yeah.
So to chuck more money at it was starting to get silly, so yeah. I knocked it on the head.
Yeah, so you just buy a couple of...
Just bought a couple in now because the museum wanted a couple more pigs in. So a guy who used to work here left here and he went on to become the... park manager up there. So through our links with him, we got a couple of pigs from Adam Henson's farm.
Yeah, so you've got quite a diverse set of activities here, looking after this and the charcoal burn, looking after the pigs.
Yeah, we have woodland here. We have 5 acres of woodland here. We're on 5 acres site here. We manage all the paths that run up for the Forestry Commission. We have an 11-acre woodland over at Little Dean. It's got a Norman camp at the top of it. So that's quite historical. That's the name of that place is Dean Camp, and that's the first recorded writing of the word Dean within the Forest of Dean. So it's quite important as far as that's concerned. And with the Norman Camp in that up there, you know, it's an unusual place given to us by Cyril Art.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Clayton, and good luck with everything.
No problem.